Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press.
Hello.
Now, having said all this, why aren't I 50 points ahead, you might ask?
One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides.
What Boehner is angry with is the American people holding him accountable.
If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems.
Well, I don't know why that's funny.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Rob Long and Peter Robinson. I'm James Lilacs, and today we have Mitch Daniels of Purdue University and Andrew Klavan on his new book. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everyone, to this, the Ricochet Podcast, brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. And we're brought to you by a new sponsor, SimpleSafe. Protect your home the smart way without the expense of long-term contracts using SimpleSafe. Visit simplesafe.com/ricochet. Go right now, and you'll also get free shipping on your order and a free keychain remote worth $25. Visit simplespace.com/ricochet to get started. And we're brought to you by Harry's Shave. For a great shave at a great price, go to harrys.com and enter the coupon code. Ricochet at the checkout. And, of course, we're brought to you by that thing called Ricochet itself, that glorious grand enterprise, which Rob Long is now here to get on his knees, skinned as they are, scuffed as they are.
Scuffed, and just debase myself. If you are...
But wait, Rob. Yes. You know, usually you have all the time in the world here to give this. I'm going to use the conventions of your industry and say, elevator pitch. And what's more, in Los Angeles, the elevators can't go more than 5-6 floors, right? So
yeah,
it's got to be a short bit. Doors are closing. I'm off to a meeting. Here I am with this upstart who's got something to sell me. Elevator pitch. Ricochet, go.
Elevator pitches. I'm always terrible at them. Anything you buy that you can be sold in an elevator, how good could that be? I will tell you this. Ricochet is a fast-growing center-right conversation site on the web. We have no trolls because everyone's a member and people pay a little bit of money every month to be part of the club. And if you have skin in the game, you don't turn the conversation into some kind of swamp, which is you and I know is the rest of the internet. We are bringing to you all of these great podcasts, and we are thrilled to do it, but we really do need your support, and we do need you to join. So please go to ricochet.com and become a member. You get a free month. There's absolutely no risk to you, and you can check out our conversations. You can check out the people, other members, and you can discover and learn and enjoy an internet the way the internet should be, which is civil. We would like to also thank our – we have a bunch of new listeners on Slate's Panoply Network. That's Slate, Slate.com, Panoply Network. So there are probably some listeners here, my friends Peter and James, who may or may not share our varied but nonetheless our basically unified political perspective, which I think is good because why just talk to ourselves? Let's talk to other people too.
Exactly. And Peter Robinson is one of those people to whom we talk. Peter, Rob used the phrase member feed, which brings to mind Anthony Weiner and the question as to whether or not you find it odd that there is absolutely no political fallout whatsoever for the Hillary Clinton campaign, given her proximity very close to this guy. Would it be different if the shoe were on the other I don't even want to think of any parts.
I don't know. The idea of Trump sexting. No. We don't even want to imagine that. But there was fallout in the sense that Huma Abedin, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, mm-hmm. who is Hillary Clinton's longtime closest aide, is now done with Anthony Weiner. She's broken up with him. It's over.
Yeah, but that was before the Daily Mail story about the 15-year-old who now apparently has recanted, even though the FBI. Da, da, da. I bring this up because the Trump campaign brought out a press release about this, which is something that the genteel GOP never would have done before, right? This would have been beneath. And one of the reasons that everyone loves Trump is that he fights.
Yes.
And he is not going to take the political correctness, et cetera, and all that. And I thought of that because one of the things that's on the topic sheet today is when we have the police shootings here and the terrorist acts there, who does this benefit? And part of me just
absolutely recoils at even phrasing it that way or thinking it that way. But we have to, and it's natural. So we are in an era then where political candidates are going to capitalize on the perversity of the ex, soon to be ex-husband of one of the aides to the campaign. And the other side is going to be actually using a blown-up pressure cooker as means to get the office because they're trying to prove a point. So I go from there. I'm not sure what question I'm phrasing other than everything about this election gives me the absolute creeps.
Yeah, that's fair. It gives me the creeps too. There's no doubt about it. So rioting and terrorist attacks, that's easy, right? Don't we think that benefits Donald Trump? That he's the one who's standing for law and order and Hillary Clinton is making more mealy-mouthed statements about we must extend understanding to – and there are people who are doing violent things in the streets without any justification at all. That's Trump advantage. I hate to put it this way, but that seems to me Trump advantage.
Especially North Carolina.
Absolutely right, of course. And – but you're right, James. As a matter of fact, the Huma Abedin, Anthony Weiner thing, if that has any political implications, I think that's got to be a Trump advantage as well in the narrow sense that – Trump, what it may very well all come down to, but for sure as the polling stands right now, what it comes down to right now is suburban women, largely married women. We know that single women tend to vote Democratic. Hillary Clinton has their support. We know that Donald Trump has the support of males by a large margin, where Trump still needs to get traction if he's going to break this open and move ahead in the polls is suburban women. And I am married to one, and her response to Anthony Weiner is yuck.
Rob, let me ask you though, when it comes to the terrorism, the riots, one of the things that Trump got a lot of attention for yesterday, Thursday, Wednesday, was saying it's time to bring back stop and frisk, which a lot of people are saying. Yeah, there was McDonald, the war on the cops, et cetera, Ferguson effect, all that. That since there was the diminution of policing at the molecular level in these neighborhoods, you have more crime. And Trump seems to have taken that to say we're going to have a national policy of taking guns away from people who look like they have them, which stirred up some people who find themselves to be constitutionalists. How did you take that? Can he say we're going to take away guns? And people will nod because they think they hear he's going to take away guns from the right people, not the wrong people.
Or the people who shouldn't have. I don't really know. I mean, it's another stupid thing that Donald Trump says about what he's going to do with zero interest in the limits. The limits of the federal government. I mean, the problem with that, the gun issue is that. It is also my problem with Trump in general is that he seems to toxify issues that I would ordinarily agree with. I mean, stop and frisk is actually stop, question, and frisk. And it was it's been an innovation, whether you like it or not, in a lot of metropolitan police departments, but especially effective in New York under Bloomberg, because New York under Bloomberg after 2008 had a massive deficit, and the police department and the police services simply were running threadbare. They still are. I mean, people forget that, but it's not a very well-funded program right now. Stop, question, and frisk allows police – it kind of encourages police to be sort of I don't know what the word is that instead of the word proactive, but the word is sort of now people say proactive. And it actually was effective. And Bloomberg was the one who told de Blasio when he came in, Mayor de Blasio who came in, that among all the dumb things you said in your campaign, that's the dumbest. You're going to want to put that back. You're going to want to walk that one back. You're going to need that. Trust me, you're going to need that. And, look, Michael Bloomberg is not a radical, crazy law and order nut. I mean, he's not. If you're on the left and you have a problem with Rudy Giuliani, I get it. But if you can't really argue with Bloomberg's sort of fiscal and effective policy.
And I couldn't agree with you more, Rob, that this is one where Donald – I think I understand what he's saying, and to the extent that I understand what he's saying, I agree with him. But I couldn't – what Donald Trump should be saying is, look, folks, I'm a New Yorker. Let me tell you a little something about the experience we had in New York. We got behind our police department. We hired a commissioner. This goes back. It's bipartisan. it started under Ed Koch, did some of it. Rudy Giuliani really moved it forward. Mike Bloomberg, who, although he was a Democrat, registered as a Republican, everybody knows he's essentially independent. But we learned a lot about policing in New York. Stop, question, and frisk was one technique, but other techniques involved heavily data-centric policing, where when there was an incident, right, we would flood the zone. We knew which neighborhoods were in trouble. We put the cops in those neighborhoods. And let me tell you where the crime dropped most sharply. The crime dropped most sharply in the Queens and in the Bronx. Fancy Manhattan was doing fine.
Did you say the Queens?
In Queens. I still think of one of the boroughs used to be called Richmond before it got – anyway. Anyway, in Queens and the Bronx, which are the two poorest of our – in other words, he could actually have given some remarks that put policing, modern policing, and then of course he would have said, and one of the most important factors in the success of the police was that the leader of New York, whether it was Rudy Giuliani or Mike Bloomberg, got behind the police. And the president of the United States has failed to do that. My opponent is failing to do that. So he could have actually given some sophistication. Instead, he gives this – Rob and I, who don't – we're with him on this stuff and we don't actually know what he's talking about. Why? Because he doesn't know what he's talking about.
And that's ultimately the problem with this guy, is that you hear him and then people say, oh, here's what he really means. And it's remarkably –
yeah, but well, he's got Kellyanne Conway on the staff now. He'll fumble around a couple of days from now. They'll come out with a statement that is what he really means. My view is he's fumbling his way toward the right issues, and I'm willing to cut him slack given the alternative. You're less willing to.
I am completely unwilling to, because I don't think he really knows what he's talking about or wants to know what he's talking about. I think he could easily clarify it 2 weeks later after his first clarification and say the opposite. I mean, I think it's fundamentally insulting for a president, for a presidential candidate, to march around running for president of the United States with a thin understanding of these big issues and yet a fat, fat mouth. There's just something about that I find I just find insulting. I'm just tired of being insulted by a guy who's basically skating his way through class. And I kind of feel like that as an American voter, I feel like, put in the effort. I mean, I almost don't even care what he says.
Rob comes to class prepared, and this fraternity boy waltzes in. That's really what this is. This is a college dynamic here.
I never was prepared for the class. I always bluff my way through. But this is the presidency of the United States. He's been running for over a year.
Yes.
It's 16 months now.
The alternative is?
Alternative is I don't have one. The alternative is that I don't have a candidate. The country's in bad shape. Why is there always this idea in American politics that there's a good answer or a right answer?
Precisely my point. Donald Trump is the least bad answer. That's all I would say.
Barely. Yeah. I mean, not.
Rob. It's a binary choice here. You got to vote for somebody, right? That's what we keep being told. And it's not as though you can rewind the whole political primary process back to the beginning and say to Donald Trump, you're fired. Ha ha. Wouldn't that be funny if you could use that line on him? That'd be funny. Anyway, not firing though, but hiring. Are you hiring anybody? Do you know where to post your job to find the best possible candidate? Well, posting a job in one place is not good enough to find quality candidates, especially if you just fired someone like Donald Trump says in that line. Sorry. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post all your jobs on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails, no calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. Wow. And right now you can post jobs in ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time, try it for free, ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. We welcome back to the podcast now Mitch Daniels, president of Purdue University, former governor of Indiana, former director of the Office of Management and Budget, and a co-chair of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And in some alternate universe, a good and happy and sunny place, he is currently president of the United States. Welcome back to the podcast. Hello, sir.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, Governor, it's Rob Long from Los Angeles. If people haven't heard, I should just say that you are endorsing Gary Johnson, Libertarian candidate for President of the United States. Is that correct?
News to me, Rob. No. As the
no?
temporary steward of a public university, I don't –
okay.
I haven't had any taken any overt hand in anything partisan, really, reaching into back into 2012 when this job was announced. But I what probably gave rise to that impression was that one, he did appear on campus here 2-3 weeks ago, had drew a big crowd, apparently one of the biggest and best, his folks said, that he's had. And he did a fine job. And then related to that, I was one of those, maybe I was the only one, who thought the debate commission ought to consider liberalizing its participation rules this particular year, which would have had the effect of including him. So maybe between those two recent bits of news, you inferred something more, but that's
well,
as far
I just goes. Wanted to. I want to start off on a bold note. So, what do you? I mean, what's your logic there about having him in the debates? Is it because you think he could win, or is it because you think the American people deserve to have an alternative in this really dismal year? I mean, you characterize it as this year sort of especially. What is it about this year that makes a third candidate important?
Yeah. Well, that's the right question. Let me preface it by saying that the commission listened, decided otherwise, and I respect that and align myself with the decision they have made to stay with their traditional criteria, which involved 15%, achieving 15% in the collection of recent polls. No, the question I thought ought to be asked would go a little like this. First of all, there's always been a concern or a point of view that says that you won't know about the viability of a candidate if they don't get at least one chance to appear in this venue. The 15% rule has been applied, and I think it's probably served pretty well to say that the debates ought to be reserved for people who have a viable chance to win the election. Others have said that you won't really be able to tell that about a third party unless they get a chance to perform. Maybe they acquit themselves well and vault well above 15%. In this particular year, I thought there were additional factors, including unprecedented disfavor. We've got two candidates in the major parties, each disliked by more Americans than any candidate in the history of modern polling, each
right.
of them. You've got a majority of Americans say they wish they had another choice. You have a high percentage of Americans say they're thinking about not voting because they can't get comfortable with these two choices. And then I threw in, because it interested me, that the third-party ticket this year, for whatever this means, has some real credentials more than many predecessors. Each of those two candidates has more government executive experience than the major party tickets combined.
Right.
So
right.
In view of all that, I thought it was worth thinking about. A very powerful argument was made that it's just too late to change direction and so forth, and I respect that.
Well, let me ask you a last question. As somebody who's – I'm trying to phrase this, so I'm not trying to get you into trouble, but as somebody who's been in and out of American politics for many years, somebody who's seen a bunch of presidents up close, probably some presidents that you really liked and supported, and probably a few presidents that you didn't like and support so much, but you saw them up close anyway. How, and because you're a realist and you're, I guess, sensing the way we all are, that one of these two people running for president right now and in those debates is going to be president in January, how bad is this going to be for the country? I mean, how optimistic, pessimistic? You know, go ahead.
Yeah, I generally don't need any help to get myself in trouble, but thanks for the offer.
just trying to keep it within the lines there that you have.
I appreciate it. I'm born and bred optimist, obstinately so about the American experiment. Wrote a book just a few years ago that took that point of view. I've asked myself a time or two, would I write the same book this year? And I confess I'd think a little harder about it. But no, I mean, our institutions have proven durable. The American people's common sense has proven likewise. There are checks and balances, thank goodness, that Jimmy and the boys wrote into the scheme from the beginning. So the mechanism has all the possibilities for self-correction if it's needed. But I agree we're in new territory here. I just gave you some of the factors that strike me as novel, and one way or another, that next presidency may be likewise.
Well, what do you think that Peter wants to jump in? But since we know that a deeply unpopular person is going to win the presidency, pretty much, we're pretty certain that's going to happen. What advice would you give that person? Somebody who's watched this stuff unfold over the years, what would be the first thing they should do when they take office?
I would hope that person, as I hoped every candidate all year long might do, would try to speak the language of unity. It's late in the game, I understand, but you're right. Something new we'll have a new situation come November. One of these people actually will have the responsibility. Maybe they will persuade themselves or someone will persuade them to build a fusion type administration to reach out and try to show some unifying leadership on a couple of the huge questions we have. The one that preoccupies me the most is the fiscal catastrophe we're engineering for ourselves. But there are other choices. In their own interest, try to reshuffle the deck, which right now you're quite correct is stacked with 50 or let's say half the 52 cards on one side and half on the other, and in a very adversarial way that not only is sort of unpleasant, poisonous in terms of the politics of the day, but militates against dealing with the very, very real problems we've got.
Governor, I don't. This is Peter Robinson. We've known each other so long that I was about to say Mitch, but I realized I should say Governor, and then I thought maybe I should say President Daniels. Anyway, Mitch, I have a question.
Yeah, you were right the first time.
Okay. Rob just said, what advice would you offer the candidate? I want to get to Purdue and higher education in a moment, but here's my last question on the current political conundrum. President of Purdue University, you stroll across the campus and you see kids 18 to 22 years old. You have graduate students, but all your undergraduates are about to cast a vote for president for the first time. You don't endorse, you stay away from partisan politics, but if one of those Purdue undergraduates walked up to you and said, and he or she would say, President Daniels, what questions should I be asking myself about these candidates in deciding how to cast my vote? How should I think about this choice? What's your answer?
First, which is most likely to create or try to create the conditions for a growing and prosperous private economy? If we don't get that right, nothing else will matter very much. We won't have the revenues even for a limited government that some might prefer, let alone the larger government that we have and others believe is best. Secondly, who will explain to me as this hypothetical young person what they're going to do so that I'm not. I don't have an impossible debt burden dumped on me.
Right.
In my working years, me and the kids I may have. Who will see that? Pursuant to that, there is some sort of safety net there for me and for my children. I think those are the two starting questions. They're closely interrelated because you can't start to moderate the coming debt crunch if you don't have faster growth. But that's what I'd be looking for. And I hasten to repeat that I think those questions are relevant regardless of your philosophy of government, your choice of parties or candidates.
Got it. So on to higher education. As president of Purdue, you have in this season in which free speech seems to be coming under, to me, it was incredible that it's coming under increased pressure. I thought we went through the speech code business and batted that down on campus 5-6 years ago. It's all back and worse. You've insisted on freedom of speech on the Purdue campus. You have held down, actually, I believe there's been zero increase in tuition for some years now. You know, how many years has it been at Purdue?
This is the fourth since I arrived. We're pledged to at least one more, which would be the next school year.
Okay, so zero increases in tuition, and you have instituted a student loan program that is a genuine business-like contract between the university and students in which they actually sort out your institution and students sort out what kind of debt they can carry and give them the money they need to get through Purdue and then expect to get it paid back. Quite different from the federal student loan system, which is take the money and then default if you want to. And those are three big innovations. Do you have the feeling that higher education in America is following Purdue's example, or are you an outlier? Are you out there by yourself?
Well, I don't think we're alone. I'd say I never suggest that anybody should follow anything we're doing. We're not preaching or prescribing to anybody else. We're trying to do what we think is best by one university and its students and what is consistent with our tradition here, which is one of first we're a land-grant school. We were placed here to keep the doors of higher, open the doors of higher education to people of modest means. Secondly, we're a place of rigor and scholarship, and we try to protect that tradition and nurture it. So I don't see yet, I see glimmers, but not enough, not as much as one might wish, of real concern for proving the value, delivering proven value in higher ed, which is a combination of rigor, protecting free inquiry, fostering critical thinking among our students, and doing all that at a price they can afford. Everything we're doing here at Purdue, one way or another, wraps up in that. I talk about higher education at the highest proven value, and I think there's still room for improvement across the across the board.
And one more question. We've got – I say one more for me, and then I know James Lilacs would like to ask a question. So here's my last question for now. We opened – you and Rob opened by talking about what a catastrophe the current election is, two candidates that nobody seems to want. At the same time, gee, there's a lot of interesting activity taking place in the states. You accomplished a lot as governor of Indiana. Texas has no state income tax and low regulations, and they're still cutting more taxes and reducing more regulations. And at the level just below that of the executive branch in Washington, Speaker Ryan and the House Republicans have developed a plan which isn't getting much attention yet, but I believe they intend to run on in the final 2 or 3 weeks of the campaign, called A Better Way, which, as best I can tell, is a very serious and extremely useful attempt to address just the issue that you most care about, which is the budget problem. So you've got a presidency, an executive branch that seems just wildly dysfunctional, and yet at one level down, the states, not all states, of course, and maybe even a minority of states, but they're fascinating. The country seems ready to function if only we could get the presidency off our backs. What do you – are we suffering some kind of – here's the question. The question is as follows. You hear more and more these days on the liberal side that the Constitution is an anachronism, that the Senate holds back progress, that we need more power in the executive. Do you have from the other side a similar critique that somehow or other we've got a constitutional imbalance, that the government is dysfunctional because it's institutionally somehow askew?
Well, actually, there's a lot to what you say, and to me, it validates the constitutional arrangement we have, because by setting up a federal system, it is intended, first of all, to protect liberty by avoiding the centralization of all power, and a lot of that's eroded away, and is the source, I think, of much of the difficulty we have. But I think you're quite right. I think there are a lot of states doing a lot of very effective things, and that's the best self-corrective mechanism I know of for the improvement of government. If you screw it up long enough, people leave, businesses leave, sooner or later, folks in the state that has been poorly governed decide to do something different. And here in the Midwest, we bless some of our friends on the coast who act like they're doing people a favor to let them hire somebody who
right.
regulate and tax in a way that is leading, as you've noticed, tons of people and businesses to leave states like that and go to places like Texas and Indiana. And, on a parochial basis, that's really good. I mean, Illinois has been a boon to our state here, frankly. But my own view is that over time, you really want other states to get their own act together in the interest of us all. And so the constitutional arrangement that makes that possible, I think, was a work of genius, and we're seeing it in action today.
President Daniels, James Lilacs here with the last question from Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the University of Minnesota, which is a huge and sprawling campus. And perhaps because it's so large, we don't hear a lot of safe space snowflake stories like we do from elsewhere. But recently, the University of Chicago came out with a manifesto or a reply to these people who want to shut down debate, and they came out in favor of it, a favor of free expression. And you backed them up last Friday talking about how Chicago is a leader in the area and we need to foster freedom of expression. But when you look around the country, you see people who are looking at what, you can call it the special snowflakes at the universities, but really they're just sort of Bolshevik thugs who want to shut down a lot of debate. And people look at this and they look at the costs of college and they look at somehow the non-utility of some of these liberal degrees, and they wonder whether or not college itself has become an institution that is beyond redemption, and that really we should look beyond it and find a new way to train kids to handle the future. How do we make college relevant again? And should we stop pretending it's for everybody?
I understand the frustration and even the dejection of a lot of people surveying the scene, which is in too many places just as bad as you just mentioned. The conclusion I adhere to, however, is that no, we've got, with all its faults, we've still got here in America a competitive edge. We've got the finest network of higher education universities anywhere. Talented minds, young minds from all over the world still want to come here. Purdue has, I think, the third most international students of any American university, for instance. So I'm for trying to encourage improvement or restoration of the all the elements and ideals that have made it great over time. I'm guardedly optimistic that the excesses and really some of the ludicrous actions of the authoritarian elements on these campuses, they sort of become grist for late night monologues. Some of it is so preposterous. Is beginning to generate a little movement of the needle back toward the center. One reason, by the way, is that some of these excesses are starting to bite the faculty. You have lots of faculty who now are being hauled into kangaroo courts and things on campuses for some just trying to teach, or for some inadvertent sentence, some classroom technique that someone took offense at. So I think maybe that this thing may start to head back the other direction. The minute I saw the what I like to call the Chicago principles, this is now almost 2 years ago, I called President Zimmer and said, we at Purdue want to enunciate a similar point of view, and I don't think we could do any better than that. Would you mind if we more or less Xeroxed yours? He said, fine, and we did, and now a few other schools have done the same. And, you know, all credit to them and to all those good folks who are reminding people that free inquiry is not only important on a college campus, it's the essence of the higher ed experience, and that where we've lost our way, we need to find it again.
Well, that's a hurtful, heteronormative, cisgendered, patriarchal way of looking at it. And I'm wounded, and I'm going to have to let you go. Thanks for being on the podcast today. We'll talk to you later.
Mitch, thanks so much.
Thanks, Governor.
All right, y'all. Take care.
It is laughable from the outside to look at the people who require safe spaces with Play-Doh and puppies. But on the other hand, I mean, the people who accommodate this are the people who really do want to shape the debate in ways that shut down free inquiry, because it renders entire sections of things you can't talk about them, because it's going to trigger somebody. And if you spend enough time on the other side of the – yes, Peter?
No, this is Rob. You say, but it's nice to feel safe, though. I mean, everybody wants to feel safe.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I would personally like a safe space. I just don't know how to go about getting one.
I do, too. And I feel safe in saying that a lot of people are looking forward to Drew Klavan coming up next. Drew is the author. What are you laughing at, Rob?
What's so funny, Rob Long?
Could it possibly be that Rob Long, who doesn't know how many people are listening to this for the first time because it's just hit Slate, they have no idea why you came in that intonation, why you interrupted me thus. Well, let me tell you, everybody, here's the thing. But Rob Long thinks that I'm going to a commercial, that I'm somehow gently, expertly, almost invisibly transitioning to what I'm about to say. Rob will stick his foot in and then engage in some sort of loud, rippling rhetorical flatulence that blows apart any attempt I had to try to gently move into the commercial seamlessly, as was done in the old days. See, that's what he was doing right there about the whole safe thing, because Simple Safe is our new sponsor, and we're proud of them, and you need to listen to this, because it's possible that you're one of the people they are trying to reach. Thousands of people, you could be one of them, you're seeking home security, but you get ripped off. You get locked into long-term contracts. You get stuck writing huge checks with no way out because you sign on the dotted line and that thing goes into infinity. It's robbery. You know it. And it can cost you thousands. I've been there myself. Now, however, there's a smarter way to protect your home. Simple, safe home security. It was built by Harvard-educated engineer Harvard, that's right, and his best friends. They were all victims of burglary, and their possessions were stolen. And, you know, obviously they wanted to get some home security, but they were renters, and they weren't allowed to install the wired system. So a brand new system was invented, created, wireless, portable, easy to install, with no long-term contracts. That's the part I like. Here's why Simple Safe's a better choice. Superior protection with a 24/7 professional monitoring and police dispatch. No annual contracts, three of the most beautiful words in the language. Traditional alarm companies will lock you into three-year contracts with these nasty auto-renew clauses, pages upon pages of fine print. Your price goes up? No, not here. Monitoring for less than half the cost of traditional alarm companies. 24/7 professional starts at just $14.99 per month. And SimpleSafe does not charge activation, installation, or any other hidden fees. Built-in cellular signal. You don't have to pay for a landline phone. Plus, a cellular connection is faster than a landline and safer. Unlike those traditional systems, burglars can't cut it, which they've been doing in our neighborhood. They cut the alarm lines, not with cellular. It's user-friendly wireless design and easy-to-do-it-yourself installation. SimpleSafe designed a home security system that's extremely user-friendly and can be installed by anybody in under 30 minutes without turning a screw. Best of all, pricing transparency. All the costs explained up front on the website. You're in control from start to finish, and you're never hit with extra hidden fees. So order directly on the SimpleSafe website, and then they ship the system to your doorstep. You put it in. There you go. Unbeatable protection, a great value, and no contracts. So protect your home the smart way. Visit SimpleSafe.com/ricochet. Go right now, and you'll also get free shipping on your order and a free keychain remote worth $25. It only takes a minute to get started. Use our coupon code RICOCHET. We thank them for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Now, as I mentioned, Andrew Klavan is coming on. Drew's an author, screenwriter, essayist, nominated for the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Awards 5 times, won twice, and his weirdly named podcast, The Andrew Klavan Show, imagine that, is available right here in Ricochet. His new book is The Great Good Thing, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. You know, you've got a new book. It seems like we say this about every 4 or 5 weeks, but this one is different. It's not a children's book. It's not an adult mystery, which will soon be made into a movie that we will love. It's a personal story. And, you know, tell us about that without exactly obviating the need for people to buy the book.
I will try not to stop them in any way from buying the book. It's a memoir. It's a conversion story. It's the subtitle is called The Great Good Thing, and the subtitle is A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. And that's actually the story. And it's the story of how over the course of 35 adult years, basically, I went from being in not just a secular Jew, but in a secular world. I mean, I've lived in New York. I've lived in Hollywood, where any sign of God, you know, it's like they have an anti-aircraft gun. If an angel flies by, they shoot him out of the sky. You know, so I was immersed in this secular atmosphere, which I kind of think is the default setting of the age, you know. And so I thought it would be interesting to show people why over time, really, you know, just using reason, there's no road to Damascus experience or anything like that, no flash of lightning. It was just thinking things through. I came to the conclusion that I was a Christian.
Drew, Peter here.
Hey.
Rob is – you've heard him chuckle once already. But
you know this?
Rob, can you please just help Rob get over what he's experiencing right now, which we know, well-bred Episcopalian that he is a kind of ick factor.
Yes.
What? Talking about religion? Talking about faith? Ugh! So how can you help Rob? How do you achieve a kind of conversational comfort on this?
It's this old deal joke is how do you make an Episcopalian look at his shoes? You mention Jesus or money.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine once said every time he hears somebody say Jesus, what he hears is Jesus, you know.
Yeah. Right.
I think that is the problem. And, you know, that's exactly what the book is talking about, because it's everywhere. It's this cloud. People feel that you're preaching to them if you talk about religion, but they don't realize that they're being preached to every single minute. I mean, think of the way we speak about ourselves at this point, where we say, I'm on an adrenaline rush, instead of saying, I'm excited. Or we say, you know, I'm hardwired for this or programmed for this, or I'm on a dopamine high. You know, everything is about the fact that we are machines, that we are mechanical chemistry. We're a cross between a chemistry set and a computer. And everything in the culture is basically teaching us this, so that when you say to yourself, well, wait a minute, maybe those machines are powered by something else. Maybe they're powered by something that comes before the machine. Everybody kind of looks at you going, you know, are you a hick? Are you a rube? Are you talking about being unscientific? And so, yeah, I think it's really difficult to get past that ick factor. When we were discussing the subtitle of the book, the first thing they said was, how about a secular Jew comes to Christ? And I said, you know, even I find that icky. Even I wouldn't read that, you know. So it's very hard to find language that is not Christianese, that doesn't put people off, that assures them that you are talking about a very, very reasonable proposition.
What about this for the next edition? Subtitle, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ but Retains His Fondness for Gin and Tonics.
All right, now you sign me up on that one.
Exactly. As long as you don't have to let go, as long as I don't have to pry my fingers off my whiskey, I'm in good shape. And, you know, this is the thing about this. I'm such a worldling. I have been my whole life. You know, I love the world. I love the corruption of politics. I love the fact that everybody is thinking about sex every 2 minutes. I mean, one of my visions of heaven is going to be a big television room with like an endless bowl of cashews and an endless bottle of scotch, where I can just watch what happens next, because the world is a fascinating place and I don't want to let it go. You know?
So
wait a minute. Hold on a second here. Scotch, blended Canadian We need a schism right now. We may agree on Clavinism, but we need a schism. Prompt, yeah. Stat.
What kind of cheap heaven are you in? It's single malt, man. It's McAllen's 12.
All right, well, it is McAllen 12. I see. The 24 is a little bit too sherry-like for you. I got it. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little smoky for me after that. Yeah.
So to what extent – how the Christianity that you have embraced. I'm trying to draw distinctions here between, well, we've already talked about the ick factor and the Jesus, the sort of mega churches that we see on cable television on Sundays. And what about the old strain of Puritanism? I grew up in a family where my parents could still remember, not remember, they were raised this way. My mother was raised in a rural setting in which on Sundays you went to church and you were permitted to sew. And that was it. When I was a kid, my father, there was a lingering Puritanism even in our family. I had to really work on him to get permission to go see a movie on a Sunday. And so the Puritanism that is – you have nothing to do with any of that.
Well, you know, I mean, you know the books I write. I write these books that are full of sex and violence and thugs and all this. And one of my favorite – one of the shows I think is one of the most Christian shows out there was The Sopranos, which is just filled with, you know, nudity and all this. When I was wrestling with this decision, when I realized that this had come upon me against my will and against my expectations, one of my most frequent prayers was, "Dear Lord, whatever happens, don't let me become a Christian novelist," because I was so afraid, you know.
Although those books sell.
They sell like crazy, you know, but I was so afraid that I would go from being a guy who writes stories about, you know, guys with gats and girls and like long sheath dresses to writing about like a little girl who lost her bunny and Jesus brought it back again, you know. I think, look, the thing is, if there's a God, God is God of the real world, this world. He's not God of Candyland. And so, yeah, I am an anti-Puritan. I have nothing puritanical about me. In fact, sometimes I think I err in the other direction. I mean, people are people. And I think that these are the people that God is rumored to love.
Drew, the Sopranos. Sopranos. This may help. This may throw a big light on what's happened to your thinking. How is The Sopranos, one of the most Christian shows out there?
It's an amazing show in which goodness, the fact of absolute morality, is sketched in silhouette. So you never see it, but it's what cuts the figures out. There's a wonderful scene where the wife, Mrs. Soprano, Mrs. Tony, goes to a Jewish psychiatrist and tells him all her problems. And he says, look, you're married to an evil man. You'll never be at peace until you leave him. And she's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. There's another episode.
And he says, I won't take your blood money. I won't take your blood money.
And the other episode, which is amazing, is somebody prays to Jesus to save somebody. If he'll save somebody, I'll convert. And the guy is saved. And people start to be haunted in the show by the people they've killed. The spirits of the people they killed come back to haunt them. And at the end, everybody just ignores it. They just go back to doing what they were doing before. And there's a cynical toast where they say, God is good, you know, and they toast each other and they go on being mobsters. I thought that was the most honest depiction of religion in real life that I had ever seen, that we get these signs. I mean, life is a lot like that Jim Carrey film, you know, Bruce Almighty, where he's driving along saying, send me a sign. And he goes by a sign that says, stop, turn back. And he keeps going, why won't you send me a sign? And there's another sign that says, you're going the wrong way, turn back. You know, that's what life is like. And that's why The Sopranos is such a brilliant depiction of the world, because God is in it, just nobody's paying attention.
I once was driving along with a radio host who actually sat in for Art Bell and took over his show, but it was also a theological kind of guy. He'd gone to seminary school. We were having a discussion. We were talking about God. We were talking about how some people seem more attuned to spiritual natures in that they hear things, they sense things that other people don't, and that some people who strive to find evidence of God with the ease that these other people do wish that they could hear some. And as we're driving past, I looked out the window, and we passed a dog that was just walking alone down the sidewalk with one of those post-surgery cones over its head. That was the best possible visual metaphor that I possibly could be given. That was my sign. That was my Bruce Almighty sign.
It is.
I,
lo-
yeah. I love that the scene in The Sopranos as well, where she unburdens himself to the psychiatrist, who then just, you know, tells her. By the way, did I ever mention that I knew Orson Welles very well? It was just, it was a great, great scene. Rob, you had something.
Okay. Well, yeah. So when we first talked about this book, Drew, and you described it. You didn't tell me what it was really what it was about, and I kept thinking to myself, okay, well, who does it? Because like you write mysteries, like who does it?
What, do you mean, who does it?
Oh, who does it?
Who's the guy?
It's a story of like clues that are out there in plain sight, but nobody sees them. Basically,
but nobody sees them. It's kind of the opposite of every other book you've written.
That's right.
The clues are there, then you find out it's the guy that we live next door. But there is a kind of a mystery here, right? I mean, you don't point in this book to a moment. There's no, oh, and then I saw this, or then it was a crack of thunder. It was just a thing that you. I guess what I'm asking more is with the TikTok of it, like that at a certain point, you kind of realized that this had happened to you, or that you had made the, you know, faith is a choice in many ways. How did it? What was the ripple effect of the people around you who don't have that faith?
Well, you know, just talking for a minute about the kind of books I write, one of the things I point out is that all my books are about people trying to find out the truth before time runs out. so this is exactly that. And you know, I mean,
this book, it's like, who done it? Well, Jesus done it.
Jesus done it. That's right. You know, one of the most touching parts of this story, for me anyway, the most emotional parts of the story was that, you know, my father once said to me when conversion was the furthest thing from my mind. I wasn't even a believer in anything. And he once said, you know, if you ever convert, I'll disown you. And when it came to me that this was happening to me, I thought, geez, you know, my father and I were never close, but we had kind of made a separate peace and we brought calm to the family. And I thought, when I tell him this, boy, this is going to explode. And just as I was about to be forced into the position of telling him, he came down with his final illness. My entire baptism took place while he was dying, basically. I was going to New York to visit with him as he was declining, and then going to downtown to see the priest who I knew was going to baptize me. And it was a bizarre – I mean, if I had written it, Rob, you would have said – you would have edited it out. You would have just said, no one's going to buy this. And it's an incredible story, and the conclusion of it, which I won't tell you.
It's
just incredible. Yeah.
Well, it's a great book. But what about your wife and your kids? I mean, you have a life. You have people, and suddenly you announce this – I mean, what is strange about
Rob himself is trying to figure out whether he still likes you.
I have two questions. Like, one is like this is actually a traditional Christian story of somebody converting. I mean, they did do it in Roman times, and then having to explain to people who don't believe, no, this is this new thing I'm into. What was the weirdest response you got?
I think the weirdest response was from Hollywood. You know, like that I suddenly realized that there were things, you know, I as you know, I've never been able to watch my tongue, you know, that whatever I'm thinking basically comes out of my mouth. And suddenly I found myself in meetings where I really thought, you know, I'm not going to say this in exactly the way I'm thinking it, because I know it'd be the end of the meeting, you know, and I know, you know, Hollywood is this hilarious place where Mel Gibson makes Passion of the Christ and makes a gazillion dollars. And nobody follows up on it. So they make the movie Noah, but they don't make it about the Bible. They make it about environmentalism, you know, because that's what's important.
Right.
And they make the movie Exodus, Gods and Kings, and Christian Bale goes out and says, you know, Moses was a terrorist. And then they lose money on those movies, and they say, well, we can't make Bible movies because nobody shows up, you know, which is, you know, they just can't see it. So the only thing I would say is that it did put me in this really, really strange position where suddenly, for the first time in my life, I found there were things that I was a little slow to say to certain people. You know, that's kind of passed at this point. I've gone back into my motor mouth mode. But still, it was a little bit of an adjustment.
Here's the other weird question I was going to ask you. It's like, are you a better person now? Are you a better husband? You a better father? Are you a better friend? Are you better? In this, the story of the book is really about your own sort of personal, you know, transformation and process. Are you better outwardly now? I mean, do people who knew you back then say, hey, man, whatever you're taking, whatever you believe in, I'm keep doing it.
Yeah.
I was curious about that.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, within weeks of my baptism, my wife, who knows me better than anybody and has been around for many, many years, said to me, turned to me and said, this new peace and joy has come over you that is unbelievable. And I think a lot of people, I mean, one of the remarks I get most often, like on my podcast, is why, when everything is going to hell in a handbasket, are you still laughing? You know, and I
that's true.
It is true. And that's why. I mean, it really did change my entire perspective. It really made me more patient. I've never been a very patient guy. I've never suffered fools gladly. It suddenly eased that. And it really, I've never been a fearful person at all, but it stripped like all fear away. I mean, I hear things coming out of my mouth and think, and there's part of my brain saying, you know, you probably shouldn't be saying that, but I just don't care anymore. You know, it's been an amazing, amazing transformation. Yes. Is the short answer. Yes.
That's the short. Well, it was a short answer. Just to be clear. So I guess I just want to wrap it up a little bit. Cause when you're, let's go back to the ick factor for a minute.
When
you're flipping around the dial or whatever, and you see a certain kind of brand of TV Christianity or a certain kind of brand of political Christianity, do you say, those are my guys? Or do you say, oh, I wish they wouldn't?
That's a good question. Mostly the latter. It's not that I feel that people should be secretive about it or anything like this. But when I was watching Ted Cruz, whose politics, you know, whose political positions I kind of admire. I mean, he's kind of on the right wing and I like all that stuff. But when he would come in and win an election and say all the glory goes to God, I was thinking, God could care less whether you win an election, Ted.
You know, I mean, he's got not involved in the primaries.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, I could see. I wondered if he was like in the back licking envelopes or something like that. I wish that people would keep that stuff in their pocket a little bit more. Not the faith, but the piety. You know, the kind of show of piety. It does say somewhere in the New Testament that you should go off and pray in quiet and in silence. You know, and I think people should follow that advice a lot more.
Yes, because you are not a pious person.
No, I'm not. I'm not a pious. It's true. I mean, in fact, I mean, I always say that, like, you know, you joke around with the people that you like. So, like, you got to keep your sense of humor about this stuff too, because you know, you really do. And yeah, it's unappealing. You know, you think to yourself too. You're supposed to preach. You don't need words to preach with. You just need to be. You know, and it's just unappealing to have people talk like that.
To be personally pious and outwardly. So yes. It's the Augustine thing, you know, make me pure, but not yet. I'm going to be saying that up to my deathbed. I'm going to say, okay, right about now you can make me pure. Here I go.
But I'm sorry, James, hold parenthesis. There's just one question I almost have to ask.
Yeah.
So Drew, there's as the civilization collapses and as we face these two catastrophic candidates, do you find yourself as a Christian, as a new Christian, drawn to the so-called Benedict option? It's time for us to drop out, time for Christians to drop out, form their own communities, and keep alive their faith and culture in what is an increasingly hostile world. Don't waste your energies on political activity. Withdraw and reinvent the culture. Do what the monasteries did in the Middle Ages. Save what's left. Or do you find yourself saying, no, the reverse. I feel a new energy. This is the world God created. Nobody knows what's going to happen next, but we do know that we have a duty to be stewards to the best extent we can. I'm going to be even more involved. On that poll, where do you find yourself falling?
I think you have to play the game. It's just like playing a sport. You have to play for in order to enjoy it. You have to play the game as if it matters, but you have to understand that it doesn't really matter because we already know the ending. It has a happy ending. It's going to be fine, but you got to fight it like every inch is worth your blood. And so I'm not for the Benedict option, but having said that, I do believe that our solutions are going to be local solutions. I think, you know, we are going to have to rebuild this country. The consensus that we had in this country from like the 1950s on is gone. It's not coming back. That idea that we all kind of know what's right and wrong and we're just arguing over how to achieve it, that is gone and it is not returning. And so I think that the answers are going to be local answers in communities and towns and in states. We're going to rebuild what America is supposed to be, not in Washington, D.C., but against Washington, D.C. But I think to step out of that fight, you know, I think that's ridiculous. That's abandoning God's world, and it's abandoning certainly your neighbor and God's creation. I think, you know, I understand that we can't lose in the long run. But every day is worth fighting for. It's just like, you know what it's like? It's like being a doctor. You know you're going to lose that fight in the long run. Right. You know it's going to, you know everything that lives dies. Every country falls. All freedom ends. But not today. You know, that's the thing. Right. That's my deal. Not today.
Right. Right. Beautiful.
And you can really bill Medicare for what you're saying. if there's a code for that sin.
Every single day, that's right.
Are you going to be on the National Review cruise with the rest of the elitists bobbing around the Caribbean?
Nobody's invited me. I don't know what it is, you know. So I'll wait.
It's the ick factor. It's the ick factor. Worried?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's National Review. Oh, he's gone Christian on us? Oh, we can't have that. Yeah, right. Okay, well, I'm sure we'll see you there. I'm sure we'll see you, if not in that one, at some point down the road. And, of course, we'll have you back in 3-4 weeks when you've written a 700-page compendium of something else that we need to talk about.
I'll be there. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Drew.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Drew.
I wish he would almost write a Christian book, you know, because if you listen to a lot of talk radio, you hear these ads for some books and some television shows ad nauseum, and you get the feeling sometimes. Well, just as talk radio is accused of speaking to their medically sealed bubble, you suspect that Christian media is the same way, and there's not a lot of overlap between normal. Normalize that what I meant to say between secular media and the Christian messages, that they don't, there's no point at which they intersect. They used to, because when they made War of the Worlds, the great Gene Barry version, at the end of it, I mean, it's explicitly Christian. God put these microbes here and there's choir music and there's church. I mean, it's a sort of thing you can do when there's a shared set of cultural values. And as Drew said, though, he's right. Those are the 50s and they're not coming back again. And what are you going to do? But we've gained, we've lost. We've lost, we've gained. And just as we no longer have that sense of shared solid values that everyone pretty much gives belief to or lip service to, we have better consumer products as far as razors go. You had one cheap blade you could use in the old days.
I was just listening to it. I just wanted to see where you would get from the collapse of American culture to, well, pretty good shape. Go ahead.
Well, just work. I mean, there's compensations. I mean, yeah. you may indeed be living in a time of a declining civilization, but that doesn't mean that technological innovations still aren't possible, because they are, and they make your life easier. And I don't think we're declining. We're just changing, for heaven's sakes. I mean, yes, we have problems at home. On the other hand, we're sending out spacecraft to map the reaches of the solar system and finding out whether or not indeed there is water on Titan. I mean, it's a fascinating time. And in that world of technological innovation, you'd think that's, you know, a 5-blade razor isn't that big of a deal. But then again, it's not like you're scraping a satellite across your face every morning, and a razor is something you have an intimate relationship with. And that's why Harry's is why you need to go to harrys.com now and start buying the razors. Now, for quality and the price you pay, it's extraordinary. Big razor companies, you know, Big Blade, have a habit of putting out new models and raising their prices, which are already high. Well, unlike those guys, Harry's does not believe in upcharging, which is why they made their razors better than ever, and they're keeping the prices exactly the same. Harry's, that's right. Better razor, same price. The 5-blade razor now includes a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for those hard-to-reach places, a lubricating strip, and textured handle for more control when it's wet so you're not dropping it in the shower. Still just $2 per blade compared to 4 or more that you'll pay at the drugstore. Now, by owning the factory in Germany where they make the blades, Harry's can produce high-quality razors themselves and sell them online for half the price. But there's even more. There's more, I tell you. They're so confident in the quality of these blades, they're going to send you the popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, a 5-blade cartridge, and some shaving gel, and you get it free. You get that free when you sign up for a shave plan. You just pay for shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for you. If you enter the code RICOCHET at checkout, you'll get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. So go to harrys.com right now and enter the coupon code RICOCHET at checkout to claim your free trial set and post-shave balm. That's harrys.com, coupon code RICOCHET at checkout. And we thank Harry's for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. All right, gentlemen, before we go, the debate's coming up. Can't wait. Not a fan of either of them. Not a fan of Trump, as people might know. I think that he actually has an advantage in this. I really do.
Why? Explain.
Because debates are generally boring exchanges that have nothing – that where nobody really talks to the other – what the other person says. If there's anybody who's going to bust that paradigm, it's going – like he's going to take it like a bar of cold Turkish taffy and slam it on the table until there's just sharp little shards. It's Trump. And he's also going to – he's going to say things that just aren't said in debates, which is why a lot of people are going to win. And so the novelty factor there I think is just going to get him a lot of – the people who think that, well, he just has to be presidential and grip the podium and look serious and show that he's not a madman. I don't think – yeah, okay. But people are going to be tuning in to watch him land blows. And well, Rob
– Call it, James. Before we leave, call it. And when I say call it, I don't mean – I don't mean who wins the debate. I mean who – which gets bigger viewership, the debate or Monday Night Football?
Interesting. It depends which team has vowed to take the knee during the anthem, I suppose. I don't know. I have no idea what the what is Monday Night Football poll? 21, 25 million? I don't know.
I'm just – anyway. Sorry.
You mean prime time football, prime time television football is – you know. I think this will be a big getter. I mean, I think this could be a big ratings get, the first one anyway. And if the first one is inconclusive or has some fireworks, then the second one will be even bigger. But I think it's true. I mean, it passes prologue. I mean, I think Trump does well in these things because he's, you know, he's tenacious and he's kind of unexpected and he's sort of, you know, he's honing in on some good themes. I think. I mean, not themes that. I mean, I'm just politically political analysis. It is a good theme to say over and over again. If you vote for her, nothing will change. That is a very, very good line.
Yes. Yes. And if you were on the debate prep team. If you're on Trump's team, you can it effectively like football is on my mind now because I mentioned that Monday Night Football thing. But you can run tapes of Hillary, and you know that's what you're going to get. Trump goes in there knowing what he's going to be up against. He even knows that there will probably be one or two Hillary surprises, but they'll be so calculated that again you feel you know what you're getting. If you're on Hillary's debate prep team, oh my goodness. How can you possibly prepare for this? Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think for her side, it's she has had one experience in a debate with Rick Lazio when she was running for Senate, and he overstepped and was too aggressive about the impeachment Monica Lewinsky business, and it really hurt him. And you saw the dials right afterwards; they were very, very bad. He was too pushy. So both of these candidates know about that debate. It was a New York debate. I'm sure that someone's mentioned that to Trump. So Trump has got, like, inside his head, he's got this, well, I think he does. If I overstep too much, it's going to, you know, sympathies will go to her. So, I mean, I think that's why it's really interesting, right?
Yes,
that's why
is.
This is going to be fascinating, because it's not as if we're looking at two candidates who are presenting their policies and are going to present the reason. This is not a fundamentally, philosophically, politically different people who've lived their lives politically differently from, you know, Carter, Reagan, Mondale, Bush, Dukakis even.
Or contrast what's going to happen Monday in your mind, Rob, with Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama.
Well, those are two people who really deeply differ on policy, who differ on the way that what government should do, although what hurt Mitt ultimately was that he wasn't different enough, you know. I mean, Romney care and Obamacare are pretty similar. So it was a clash of personalities, but also a clash of ideas. But I don't think either one of them had the other living inside his head.
Yes. Yes. Good point.
And you could tell that in the first debate, the Romney Obama debate, because Obama lost. He was kind of lackluster. Wasn't really paying attention to what was going on. That's how kind of unimportant it was, or how unpsychologically tormenting it was. That is literally impossible, I think, for these two candidates. They are already preparing for the other's insults, and they're already living inside each other's heads. You know, these are two people who are driving each other crazy, and we're going to see them meet in person, and it's going to be interesting. I mean, it's going to be really interesting. To the extent that policy is brought up, or policy has been brought up at all in this campaign, that will be the boring part. The most interesting part will be how each one of them presents him and herself, knowing and anticipating the feints and parries of the other. And it's all psychological. It's all, you're going to make me look old. I'm going to make you look stupid. You're going to make fun of me. It's all this weird after school, you know, taunt session that is not good, and it's not a positive development for the American culture and politics, but it sure is going to be gripping.
Too bad there's an audience. Because Trump feeds off an audience. I mean, when he gets going and he starts to get his licks in, he really – you can just see him sort of inflating and gaining mana and power when the applause goes for something that was a little outre. I don't know. Peter, you're the debate coach. What do you tell Trump?
What do I tell Trump? I guess I'd say, what would I tell Trump? I would say to Trump, your objective is very straightforward. Be yourself, dialed back. Dial it back. Don't be Rick Lazio. Come up to the line, but don't be Rick Lazio. I would also be working. Let's see, if I had to schedule this, it's already too late for what I'm about to say, but I'd overbrief him. I'd make sure he actually had some familiarity with the issues. And then take away the briefing books and just have him go through it question by – just pepper him with questions and see how he's responding on his feet. But there's not I just – I'm trying to think. So we know – I believe it's been in the press that Roger Ailes is helping with the debate prep. And what is Roger going to say? What Roger's going to say is – Roger's going to say you need to be tougher. You need to demonstrate that you're tougher than she is, but everybody already believes that. You need to demonstrate a basic stability. Here's what you need to do. You need to walk off the stage that night having your audience thinking to themselves, you know, I could see that guy as president. That's the goal. That's the goal. Right. You need to achieve plausibility. That's really the overriding goal.
Yeah. I would be a little bit more granular than that with him. I mean, no. I think what I would say to him is you do not need to convince anyone who is currently voting for you to vote for you. They are going to vote for you no matter what. You need to convince people who think you're unstable and irrational and immoderate. And so you need to hit over and over again, I'm the candidate of change. You know, you don't like the way things are going. They've had 8 years and they've blown it. If you want change, you vote for me. And then the second thing you say is, I'm a normal, moderate, rational person. The normal – you make them seem weird and you seem normal. Them seem crazy and you seem moderate. And you are a moderate. You play the moderate in that debate. You will not lose your base, but you will enlarge it to include you know, a lot of those married women, a lot of college-educated white people who are right now not on your side, who think that you're irrational and that you don't have any control over yourself, that you are emotionally unstable. And I feel like that is – it's probably saying the same thing as you're saying, Peter, but I would just give him keywords to say. These are the keywords to say, which – look, I'm just, let's be rational about this. Let's be moderate about this. Let's be thoughtful about this. All of those words, those weasel
measured.
Words that I'm sure –
yes, exactly.
Measured, that I'm sure you hate. Donald Trump, you're going to have to say them because you got to close the deal for people who think the opposite and of you. And I feel like that would be the advice I would give.
But the Trump supporters are back exactly where GOP presidential candidate supporters have been for years and years and years and years. And that is sort of slightly wincing when their guy starts to speak. Oh, not because they're afraid of what he's going to say. They'd love what he said, but because they're afraid of what he might say that might make people not vote for him. So it's going to be Sean Hannity will be standing in the wings, chewing a hole in the side of his cheek for the entire debate, you know, waiting for something bad to be said that he don't have to defend. Well, it'll be fun. We'll all be watching it. Never in my life have I looked forward like this to watching Hillary Clinton on television.
Sit down. and if you're a Ricochet member, we'll have it live chat.
And I actually think that the Lazio comparison isn't exactly that accurate because then she had perhaps a little bit of protectiveness. Now she is, I think, if she can't handle somebody really putting the wood to her rhetorically, then you have to ask, well, how can you stand up to Putin? Et cetera, et cetera. We'll see. How many debates are there going to be? 15, 16, 17? I don't know. We'll be tired of them all. But the place to go to have live chat and to speak and riposte and joke would be Ricochet, where we'll be setting that up on Monday. But in between now and then, of course, there's the member feed with lots of interesting stuff, which you can't read if you're not a member. So be one of the 1,500 and enjoy that fast-scrolling panoply of exciting topics, which range from Star Trek to art to wine to movies to politics to politics to politics to politics. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the members, and we wouldn't be here without our sponsors, which include ZipRecruiter.com, Harry's Shave, and SimpleSafe. You can use the coupon code Ricochet for all kinds of bargains in each instance. And visit the Ricochet store where you can get all kinds of branded swag to walk about in public and proclaim your love and affiliation. Hey, if you enjoyed this, please take a minute to leave a review on iTunes, and your reviews allow new listeners to discover us, which helps keep the show going. And finally, if somebody in the comments could figure out why exactly I said that the Sopranos psychiatrist brought up the fact that he knew Orson Welles, you get a bonus no prize, which I will be happy to email to you at the earliest convenience. Right over Drew's head. Rob didn't get it. Apparently, that's
I didn't get it.
I certainly didn't get it, but then you didn't expect me to get it.
I expected everybody to get it at least.
Who was the actor? Who was the actor?
Well, it was Peter Bogdanovich, wasn't it?
No. That was – no. That's exactly – that's why I didn't understand. Peter Bogdanovich was Dr. Melfi's Sopranos' shrink's shrink.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Oh, that's my mistake.
That's why we didn't get it, because it didn't make any sense.
It didn't make any sense. I'll have to send an email to Drew apologizing for that, because now I feel like an absolute idiot. But hey, it's the end of the podcast. I've already signed off and given the sponsors. Nobody's listening. Anybody listening? No. Welcome to everybody who joined us on our new network, and we'll see you here at Ricochet.com next week. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye. And James, no idiot could say Donald Trump is going to walk into that debate like a man throwing down a cold slab of Turkish taffy, leaving nothing left but hard, pointy shards. I will be floating all day in a cloud of admiration that you pulled that one off. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Next week, boys. Join the conversation.